Genesis chapter 43 is where we are this evening. Genesis chapter 43. Well, we start Genesis chapter 43 with a famine, which, if you remember, was raging last time we were in the book of Genesis, and it's still going on. Matter of fact, Genesis 43, verse 1 begins, "And the famine was sore in the land." So the famine, which was forecast to last for 7 years, is still going on and just as good as ever, apparently. And since if you remember that the boys had gone off and they had brought back sacks full of food from Egypt, so the obvious solution to the problem would be go get more food. There's plenty there in Egypt. Anybody can tell you that. But Jacob had, with some obvious personality defects that he has, had put off dealing with that particular problem, the fact that there was no more food. And so him putting off the problem, because if you remember, they had had to leave and left Simeon behind. He had been held as a little surety and been put in prison because Joseph, who had not yet revealed his identity, said, "You go back and bring your youngest brother to me," which, of course, being Benjamin. And Jacob's response to that is right there at the end of chapter 42. He said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead," meaning Joseph, "and he is left alone. If mischief befall him by the way in the which ye go, then shall you bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave." So Jacob was hell-bent in making sure that Benjamin wasn't going anywhere. Well, with that being the case, so Jacob was putting off the inevitable and the obvious, and that is go to Egypt and get food. So it came to pass, verse 2, when they had eaten up the corn which had been brought out of Egypt, their father said to them, "Go again, buy us a little food." Well, what's wrong with this picture here? Well, here's Jacob, and he's in his strange way of thinking. You're in a severe famine, and no relief in sight, and you know that there's food in Egypt, and you have all these people who are depending on you, not just the 10 brothers who are there. Of course, Simeon's, you know he's in prison in Egypt. You're going to ignore that problem. And you're looking around, you have the 10 brothers with you, and their children, and their wives, and you look around, and you have severe drought, and no means of relief. He said, "Let's go buy a little food." And so rather than something that's going to solve the problem, he's just going to dabble a little bit at a time. So you got to think, what in the world is he thinking here? Well, he's probably thinking that they had made this agreement with the governor, the head of Egypt there, but he's going to refuse to face the problem head on. If you remember, the agreement had been made for the purchasing of more grain. In verse 3, you read that Judah spake unto him, saying, "The man did solemnly protest unto us, saying, ye shall not see my face, except your brother be with you." So in other words, they were to go get Benjamin and bring him back to prove that they were not spies. Well, Jacob apparently seemed to be hoping that, well, if they just go buy a little bit of food, that maybe the terms of the agreement would be changed and he wouldn't hold them to it, rather than going buying a lot of food, and he wouldn't demand to see Benjamin. But in the meantime, no one's objecting to Benjamin going except for Jacob. He's the only one that seems to have a problem with this. And as the verse that we read just a minute ago at the end of chapter 42, He is the only one that is not agreeing to Benjamin going. And the delay in returning, this procrastination that's going on, is solely Jacob's fault. The only reason they're out of grain and out of food is because Jacob is refusing to do anything. He's sitting around not facing the problem. First of all, that there's a lack of food, that they're running out of food, and they have no more food, and that there's a solution to the problem, but he's not facing up to the problem, nor is he facing up to the solution. And here's Judah. Judah, of course, being the oldest of the brothers, and he chastises his father. Why? For putting everybody, including all the children, in danger of starvation because of just sitting around turning his back on the problem and pretending that everything's okay. He says, if you skip down to verse 10, he says, "For except we had lingered, surely now we had returned this second time." In other words, we would have already gone to Egypt and gotten back again by now if you had not been sitting around here doing nothing. If we had just taken, if you just agreed to the terms, if we had just taken Benjamin, gone to Egypt, we would have already been back by now, and that with all the food that we needed. But you've just been sitting around here doing nothing and refusing to let Benjamin go. Well, here we find that Judah is, he is the oldest brother. And he is finally stepping up into the position of the oldest brother. Finally, looking as if he's taking a little bit of responsibility and doing what an oldest brother should be doing. He's not willing to accept what his father is going to try to do, because his father wants to change the terms of the deal. Why don't you go down and buy a little food without Benjamin? And Judah said, no. The governor said that, we'd have to bring Benjamin. And Judah, of course, would be the one that would have to stand there and explain why Benjamin wasn't there, why they're not making good on the deal. And of course, they are the ones that were accused of being spies. So here's Judah standing up to his father in verses 4 and 5. He says, "If thou wilt send our brother with us, we will go down and buy thee food. But if thou wilt not send him, we will not go down. For if the man said unto us, we shall not see my face, or ye shall not see my face, except your brother be with you." So here's Judah telling his father, we're not going anywhere until you send Benjamin with us. Boy, what a slap in the face to his father. What a slap in the face to Jacob. I got to imagine that Jacob is rather stunned by this. Probably had never heard language like this from his sons. Probably never had his authority questioned by any of his sons prior to this moment. And so, when you think back on all the things that Jacob had done throughout his lifetime, all the conniving and all the wheeling and dealing and everything that Jacob had done, dealing with his brother Esau and with Laban and all the things that had gone on with Jacob throughout his lifetime, and then suddenly here one of his own sons, a slap in the face and a rebuke, and refusing to do that which he is told, he tries to reflect, lay the blame then for this whole situation on the boys, rather than, it's not my fault that we're in this situation. Which clearly Jacob is the one who is procrastinating. Jacob is the one who could have solved the problem by sending Benjamin, but yet he tries to lay the blame for the situation on the brothers, and says in verses 6 and 7, And Israel said, "Wherefore dealt ye so ill with me as to tell the man whether he had yet a brother?" So why have you, why have you told anybody that you had a brother? What business was it of his? He would have never known you had a brother, in other words, if you hadn't opened your big mouth. So you're the one who put us in this situation. And they said, "The man asked us straightly of our state and of our kindred, saying, 'Is your father yet alive? Have ye another brother?' And we told him according to the tenor of these words." So in other words, he was just asking simple questions. Is your father still alive? Do you have any other brothers? And it wasn't as if he was trying to, connive us or anything. He's just asking some questions, and we were giving him the answers. And they said, "Could we certainly know that he would say, 'Bring your brother down'? We never in our wildest dreams imagined that that would be the case. How could we have possibly known that?" And so, here's Jacob. When you think about it, here's Jacob rebuking their sons and trying to blame the whole situation on them for telling the truth. Jacob is rebuking his sons for telling this man, of course that being Joseph, the truth. So when you think about it, the old Jacob, you think back, we've been dealing with Jacob now for quite some time. And all the things that Jacob has done over this time. I mean, from the peeling of the rods to get the sheep and all the wheeling and the dealing and everything else that's gone on. The old Jacob is still alive and well. Hasn't changed a bit. And when Judah says, would you have had us say something else to him? I can almost hear the wheel spin in Jacob's head, and truth be told, Jacob's answer probably would have been, "Yes, you should have answered like I would have answered. You should have lied. Yep, you should have lied." And that's really probably what Jacob was really thinking. Yes, you should have lied. Well, so if you remember, Reuben at one time tried to persuade Jacob to let Benjamin go. That was back in the last chapter, chapter 42. Verse 37. Reuben spake unto his father, saying, "Slay my two sons, if I will bring him not to thee, deliver him to my hand, and I will bring him again unto thee." So Reuben offers his two sons as surety if he'll let Benjamin go along to Egypt. Well, Reuben, of course, he was the birthright son by fiat because of Judah's indiscretion. He tried to make that deal with his dad, and he wasn't persuaded. Well, where Reuben could not get that deal made, Judah now offers himself as surety for the safety of Benjamin. So in verse 8, Judah said unto Israel, his father, "Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and thou, and also our little ones." Judah says, "I will be surety for him." He doesn't offer anything else but himself. "I will be surety for him. Of my hand shalt thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, then let me bear the blame forever. For except we had lingered, surely now we had returned this second time." It's interesting when you read this and compare the two, Judah and his daddy. Because where Jacob has spoken really only of himself. If you look at chapter 42, verse 36, Jacob, their father, said unto them, "Me have ye bereaved of my children." And he says, "All these things are against me." And then again in verse 38, then he says, "My son shall not go with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If mischief shall befall him by the way in which you go, then shall you bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave." He speaks about all the, you know, his own sorrow and his own problem and all the things, you know, "Woe is me." So that's where Jacob is. You know, all this mischief is done, and it's how it's affected me. All these problems have come, and they're all affecting me. Woe is me. And that's what Jacob is all about. That's the only thing that he can see, is how terrible the world is and how it's all come down on me. Look at what Judah has to say in the verse that we just read in verse 43. "It's not about me, it's about us. And about we. Judah says unto Israel his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and thou, and also our little ones." It's never about me. It's never about I. It's never about a personal gain. It's all about the good of everyone. So there's a great difference between the two. There's a big difference between the personalities and the way that this whole situation is perceived between Judah and Jacob. Jacob thinks that everything is about a personal problem. Everything is done and come down on him. Judah is looking for the benefit of all the brothers and all the people that it's affecting. When you now have this pressure then applied to Jacob, you have a solution given, you have Judah given surety of himself personally, plus the pressure of the famine, you have no food available. Really, what else is there to do? You're out of choices. And so Jacob makes a decision finally, but when you think about it, it's a passive decision. It's not an active decision. Jacob doesn't take action in it. He passively gives permission for them to take action. He's not going to take an active role in it. So he takes a passive role in it, and he gives into the reality of the situation. But he decides then to sweeten the pot, so to speak, in order to win the favor of the Egyptian governor, that being, of course, Joseph. So in verse 11, "And their father Israel said unto them, if it must be so now." And you can almost hear Jacob's tone. "Oh, if it must be so." I mean, just the personal sacrifice that he himself is making in all this. It's all about his own personal sacrifice, the pain that he must be feeling. "Then do this. Take of the best fruits in the land in your vessels, and carry down the man a present, a little balm and a little honey, spices and myrrh, nuts and almonds, and take double money in your hand, and the money that was brought again in the mouth of your sacks, carry it again in your hand, peradventure it was an oversight." In other words, take back the money that we found in the sacks with the corn before, plus take more money that you can buy more corn. So he's sweetening the pot, trying to buy the favor of the man there in Egypt. And then finally, the greatest sacrifice that Jacob could ever make in the world, he turns over Joseph, not only to his sons, but to the care of God. He says, finally, take also your brother and arise. Go again unto the man, and God Almighty give you mercy before the man, that he may send away your other brother and Benjamin. If I be bereaved of my children, I am bereaved. Well, let me tell you. Was that the most spiritual thing you've ever heard in your life, or what? I would have to say, or what? Because I'll tell you, contrary to the opinions of some, I don't think that was a real spiritual breakthrough for Jacob in any way. Because I think the release of Benjamin was done more reluctantly than willingly. And I think it was done in the face of insurmountable pressure, that he just couldn't find any way else to solve the problem of the fact that they didn't have any food. He just couldn't see any other way around it. And really, the biggest thing was his sons weren't going to go anywhere. They were not going to go to Egypt until he let Benjamin go with them. He tried and tried and tried to get his boys to go to Egypt without Benjamin, and they weren't going to budge. And that was the thing that moved him, made him give them Benjamin to go to Egypt with. He had no choice in the matter if they were not going to starve to death. And as Carol says, he had no other choice. They forced him into that choice. They were out of food, and he was out of choices. Exactly right. He had no other choice. So, this was not a spiritual moment of enlightening for Jacob. Jacob is influenced more by fear than by faith, without a doubt. Influenced by the flesh, by the belly. Reality was setting in. So, when you think about it, and God Almighty, give you mercy before the man, that he may send away your other brother, but he couldn't even remember the name of Simeon and Benjamin. I mean, this isn't a prayer. A prayer is asking God for something. This is more like a wish list. There is not evidence of faith, but there's a lot of evidence of what you'd call fatalism here. Look at the very last sentence of the verse. If I be bereaved of my children, I am bereaved. You know what that reminds me of? Have you ever read the book of Esther? The book of Esther is often said by some, by many, to be a great book of faith by a young woman who does, you know, spectacular things and everything. But have you ever read the book of Esther? Did you realize the book of Esther does not have one prayer in it? And the word of God does not show up in the book of Esther even one time? And in the book of Esther, chapter 4, verse 16, is something very similar to what Jacob says here. At the end of that verse, Esther says, "And if I perish, I perish." It's very fatalistic. Oh, if I perish, I perish. It's sort of like saying, well, whatever will be, will be. Well, that's true, isn't it, Mike? Whatever shall be, shall be. Well, that is true. Whatever shall be, shall be. Well, even if I wreck on the way home and die, I just will wreck on the way home and die. Well, well, that's true. The underlying attitude really isn't very one of faith, is it? And that's what's going on here. What is being demonstrated is not faith. It is an attitude of fatalism rather than faith.
Yeah,
que sera, sera. Whatever shall be, shall be. Well, that's not a whole lot of faith, is it? Well, so the brothers take Benjamin and this gift, and they go and they stand before Joseph. Verse 15, and the men took the present, and they took double money in their hand, and Benjamin, and rose up and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. And when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the ruler of his house, bring these men home and slay and make ready for these men shall dine with me at noon. And the man did as Joseph bade, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house. And the men were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's house, and they said, because of the money that was returned in our sacks at the first time are we brought in, that he may seek occasion against us and fall upon us and take us for bondmen and our asses. That would have been the donkeys that are outside that they came with, by the way. So the brothers thought that they were being tricked into being taken servants, made slaves. That because of the money that was they found in their sacks. So they thought, well, we better explain what happened. That's our only chance. And so when they came near to the steward of Joseph's house, they communed with him at the door of the house and said, oh, sir, we came indeed down at the first time to buy food, and it came to pass when we came to the inn that we opened our sacks, and behold, every man's money was in the sack of the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight, and we have brought it again in our hand. And other money have we brought down in our hands to buy food. We cannot tell who put our money in our sacks. Well, probably a good idea. Because they were in great fear. So the steward heard their story and to calm the men, what he says is extremely interesting. He says, the steward assures the men that he was the one who received the money from them. That when they were there the first time, he took their money from them for the grain that they purchased. But when you notice what he does not say, he does not mention that he placed it back in their sacks at the order of Joseph. Because if you remember, Joseph is the one who ordered that he put it back in the sacks. The steward only says that it was God that provides treasure in their sacks. And as an assurance, Simeon, their brother, is brought out too. So as we read verse 23, the steward is speaking and he said, peace be to you, fear not. Your God and the God of your father have given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money, and he brought Simeon out unto them. Well, obviously, if you remember, we've talked about Joseph as a type of Christ in the boys and the sacks and the money as a type of salvation, as a picture of salvation. Well, the salvation of God cannot be purchased. Therefore, the price of the life-giving grain was returned to them. When you read about salvation, salvation is understood by the gospel. One of, I know, Mike's favorite verses is 2 Corinthians chapter 4 in verse 3. If our gospel be hid, it is hid to them that are lost. Paul's talking about the gospel when he says in verse 7 of that same chapter, we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of this power may be of God and not of us. We have, as the verse says, the God of your father hath given you treasure in your sacks. Well, once again, as you're reading about the sacks of corn and the money returned, the life-giving grain given at no cost, remember that what you're reading is a picture of the salvation of God. And we'll speak again about that at the end of the lesson. But the brothers are taken to Joseph's house, and that to prepare for eating of the noonday meal. And there they prepare the present that they have brought, the things from the land of Canaan. The man, verse 24, brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he gave their asses provender, and they made ready the present against Joseph. Came at noon, for they heard that he should eat bread there. So the brothers are waiting for Joseph to appear. And when Joseph came home, verse 26, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house and bowed themselves to him to the earth. Now they brought these presents in order that they might gain his favor. But to their surprise, I'm certain, rather than asking about the presents or even paying attention to them, the only thing that he is interested in is people. Specifically, the first person that he asks about is their father. And he asked them of their welfare and said, is your father well? The old man of whom he spake, is he yet alive? And they answered, thy servant our father is in good health. He is yet alive. And they bowed down their heads and made obeisance. Then Joseph pronounces what would probably sound like a very strange blessing coming from an Egyptian who didn't worship the same God, the God of the Hebrews. And he lifted up his eyes, verse 29, and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, is this your younger brother of whom ye spake unto me? And he said, God be gracious unto thee, my son. Now at this point, Joseph is overcome by emotion, which truly shows the heart of Joseph. So he has to leave in order to gather himself, not to show his emotions to his brothers. And Joseph made haste, for his bowels did yearn upon his brother, and he sought where to weep. And he entered into his chamber and wept there, and he washed his face and went out, and refrained himself and said, set on bread. And then all sit down together. Now when I say together, they sat at separate tables because, as you'll read, the Egyptians and the Hebrews never sat together. But they set on for him by himself and for them by themselves, and for the Egyptians which did eat with him by themselves, because the Egyptians might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination unto the Egyptians. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marveled one at another. And he took and sent messes unto them from before him. But Benjamin's mess was five times so much as any of theirs. And they drank and were merry with him. Now, some of the things that are extremely interesting about the story that we read, this part of the story that we read this evening. First of all, we read about Jacob. And Jacob is simply just a case. Every time we run across Jacob, there's been numerous times when he's had moments of light where we thought, this is the time where he is breaking out of his old ways and becoming a grown-up, and he's breaking into a new life of spirituality and maturity. And then only to be disappointed once again by the carnality of the old man coming to the surface. And here we are once again finding out that Jacob is still the same old Jacob that we knew all the way back from when he was a young man. A deceiver, very carnal, very fleshy, and his old ways coming out once again, and probably never left him. He isn't operating by faith, but by the flesh. And in comparison with Jacob, we really find out that Judah, his son, is just a spiritual giant by comparison. Judah has stepped up to really be the head of the brothers, and has taken a giant leap in leading the brothers. So it's just an astounding comparison when you think about it. When you think about Joseph and the position that he is in, one of the more interesting things to think about is that, of course, it's easier to make the connection between Joseph and the nation of Israel, as you see them in the land of Goshen and then serving the Egyptians and becoming a great number of people and all that. But on a that being a macro level, but on a more micro level, if you think about the relationship between Jacob and Joseph, the things that God did with Joseph, putting him into servitude in Potiphar's house, and then into jail, and then consequently, because of the dreams and the interpretations of dreams, into Pharaoh's. Before Pharaoh, and then becoming the governor of Egypt, in charge of all things, that was done as much for the benefit of Jacob as for anyone else. You see that only when you get to the very end of the life of Jacob, as evidenced by the author of Hebrews. Because all this time, as we have been looking at the life of Jacob, and we haven't quite gotten to the end of the life of Jacob yet, but we're dealing with a man who is well advanced in age, and yet is still very carnal in the way he deals with his family, with everybody else. And his relationship with God is one it's not what you'd call a very spiritual relationship. And quite frankly, when you read chapter 11 of the book of Hebrews, which is what you'd call the Hall of Fame of Faith, the best that the author of Hebrews has to say about Jacob is only about the very end of his life. It's not a very flattering thing when you think about it. Here he's included in verse 21 of the book of chapter 11 of the book of Hebrews. It says, "By faith, Jacob, when he was a dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff." So it's not until he was dying that the author of Hebrews could find a place where he could include Jacob as being faithful to God. That's not a very flattering statement. So you're dealing with someone who you're not really going to want to circle as someone that is probably the best blueprint for your life. I guess that's probably what you want to take away from all that. When it comes to family and fathering and leadership, what you get out of chapter 43, Jacob has a chance to deal with a great crisis, in that the famine was very sore. That's how that's how the chapter begins. And yet, Jacob fails miserably in the test of leadership. From what I can figure out, Jacob had pretty much a 7-part method to leading, and this could be how he handled every situation. But here's the 7 parts to his method of leadership. Number 1 is, today's problems are best dealt with tomorrow. He would procrastinate and put everything off just as long as he possibly could, until every small problem became a crisis. In other words, he knew that there was a famine in the land, but he waited until they completely ran out of food before deciding to do anything about it. No problem can be as bad as it seems. Well, he says, go on to Egypt and get a little food. Well, at this point, they were 2 years into the time of famine, as you'll see in the next chapter. There were still 5 years to go, and he wanted them to go get a little food. They didn't need just a little food. They needed a lot of food. And so he was trying to minimize the problem that was, in fact, very great. The third part of his 7-part leadership plan was, honesty is not the best policy. When the boys had told Joseph that there was, in fact, a father and a younger brother back at the house, Joseph chastised them for telling the truth. Well, honesty is always the best policy. Yeah, he could be a politician today. You're exactly right, Carol. Honesty is the best policy. Lying is never a good idea. Number 4, always look out for number 1. Well, Jacob, as you remember, was all about me, 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 while Judah was concerned with we and us. And that seems to be modus operandi for Jacob. It's all about what concerns him. Number 5, when problems arise, blame others. Jacob was the one who put off doing anything about the problem of the famine, and yet when they ran out of food, he blamed the brothers for telling the truth and the whole situation, rather than taking responsibility for not making decisions to send Benjamin back along with the brothers to Egypt to get food. Number 6, just in case, throw money at the problem. Now, as just like our government, the way it operates, Jacob thought, yeah, he could be a politician. It's Bush's fault, I see that. Yeah, hadn't thought about that one. throw money at the problem. Well, if you might have noticed that there were no need for the gifts. Joseph didn't even bother looking at the gifts that were taken by the boys. But Jacob thought, well, just in case, let's sweeten the pot with these gifts. They were wholly unneeded, but he sent them anyway to gain favor. And so he was throwing money at a problem that there was no need to do. And of course, number seven, when all else fails, trust God. And he set his little wish list with God. Of course, that wasn't much of a prayer, but rather it was just a little bit of a, let's hope God does something type of thing. So there's his seven-part plan to leadership, and I wouldn't recommend following that either, by the way. Meanwhile, Joseph's brothers provide an excellent picture of salvation throughout chapter 43. They too are in what you call a poor spiritual state, although I would make the argument that their spiritual state couldn't be as bad as their father's, but if you notice, they feared facing Joseph. Joseph, of course, being a type of Christ, and they fear, of course, facing Joseph as a sinner would fear facing God. The reason they feared facing Joseph is they perceived that their only hope for salvation, the salvation, of course, being represented by food, the bags of corn, because all they had to do was to bring their own works, and that would be the returning of the money and bringing of the gifts, hoping, of course, that that would be enough. If all you have is to bring your works to in front of God, hoping that that's enough, I would be very fearful also. You noticed then when the boys brought the money, it was refused. And of course, the first time they went to purchase the grain, it was refused by the steward and returned. The second time they brought the gifts, and they were completely ignored by Joseph. So neither of those things work. You cannot purchase salvation in any way. The relationship to Joseph was what endeared the brothers to him. They noticed that when Joseph met with his brothers, he was overcome by emotion. And in order to not reveal his identity, actually had to leave the room to shed tears in private. Their relationship to Joseph is what endeared to him. Men today are fearful of standing before God because they bring their works. They do not have a relationship to God. It is our relationship, not our gifts, not our pistachio nuts or our almonds or whatever other trinkets that we have to bring that makes us accepted with God. As Paul says in Ephesians 1:6, to the praise of the glory of His grace, wherein He hath made us accepted in the Beloved. We're accepted because He has made us accepted by His grace. It's not the other way around. The boys' money was returned into their sacks. They had nothing to do with what went on as far as the returning of money. They couldn't purchase the grain no matter how much money they had. We cannot purchase salvation no matter how many works we have. It's always by grace, and that through faith. Always, always, always that we're made accepted.